From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. It's a best of authors show today, starting with writer and physician Danielle Ofri. Her newest book asks whether you can teach a new doctor how to have empathy for her patients. Then the hero of Joshua Ferris's novel is a dentist who can't get out of his own head, thanks to his patients.
One guy's got cancer. One guy won't floss. The other guy has a cavity that he won't take care of. So these people continually keep him on notice that the march of time is working always.
And we'll consider the legend and legacy of actor John Wayne.
He loved running lines with actors. He liked working with young actors who were inexperienced and helping them get their craft the way older actors had once helped him get his craft. He liked getting there at 7 in the morning. He liked everything about the process. Very few people are like that.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. When you're not feeling good and you go to the doctor, what are you hoping for from your visit? Well, you probably want to get well, of course, but does it matter whether your doctor really seems to care about your well-being? There are reports that show it does. At the University of Wisconsin, a 2011 study of patients who turned out to have the common cold showed that patients who gave their clinician perfect marks for empathy recovered faster and had less severe symptoms than those who didn't. But doctors are people, too, and even as symptoms and test results play a role in how they treat patients, so too do emotions. Dr. Danielle Ofri has taken a close look at emotions in medicine in her work at New York's Bellevue Hospital, her occasional contributions in the New York Times, and in her most recent book, What Doctors Feel. Ofri was in Milwaukee last fall to give the annual Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She stopped by the Lake Effect studio then to talk with Mitch Tyke, who wondered if the desire to help other people is the same as having empathy.
I think they're related, but not necessarily the same thing. When we think about empathy, we think about, I think, the standard definition of can you be in someone else's shoes and look through their eyes? And in medicine specifically is can a physician or a nurse really feel how the patient is suffering? And really the origin of the words comes from sensing someone's suffering.
Well, and is it just the health issues themselves, or is there something about understanding the weight, if you will, of the medical system around them as a patient comes in the door?
Well, everyone's illness is unique, and partly because everyone's life is unique. And so how one person's pneumonia affects their life is completely different from another person's. If you imagine a healthy 36-year-old soccer player has pneumonia, out 2 days back playing soccer, an elderly widow living alone with pneumonia might send them to a nursing home. And so it completely changes their life, yet it's the same disease.
So do you think is empathy something that ought to be taught in medical school, or is it a question of recognizing it and having it reinforced?
It's an interesting concept. It's one of those things you would think is a little hard to teach. I think that we do a very good job of selecting the right medical students. I mean, honestly, in all my years of working with students, I can count on one hand the number of people who didn't really have what it takes to be a good and empathic doctor. However, when we finish training them at the other end, we know from a lot of research that their empathy is at the minimum sorely tested, if not really, you know, eroded. And so something about our training, I think, is affecting that. And so our efforts, not so much to teach empathy, but to preserve it and to model how important it remains in medical care today.
I wonder if there's something to the idea of students and young doctors being able to even simply recognize it as they're feeling it.
Well, partly, I mean, when you're thrown into the medical world, it's like being tossed into Mars without an instruction manual. It's very disorienting. The language is different. The way of dressing, the ethics, everything is different. And students who are keen observers, they watch how their superiors behave, how they walk, how they talk, how they address patients, how they address nurses, and all these things are picked up on. We often call this the hidden curriculum. So there's the explicit curriculum they learn about in the classroom, compassion, empathy, professionalism, and then there's what they see how medicine is actually practiced in the field, and it's often quite different.
Right. You write at length about your own personal experiences having worked in labs and gone through classroom settings, and then when you're actually confronted with patients that are far different than anything you would have read about in just a textbook, it's a different story altogether.
It's absolutely different story, and I think we're just not prepared, and students aren't so prepared. Patients don't read the book either, and they bring their lives to their illness, and it's really, you know, it's up to us to figure that out. And so when I look at who were the role models, they're the ones who in their practice would demonstrate empathy, to take the time to listen, to genuinely care. And those were the doctors who were different than the ones who were brusque and short-tempered, and you kind of know it when you see it.
Well, right. One of the really interesting personal examples you relate is that some of the most important lessons you received about meeting patients on their own terms came from doctors that we might have thought of as old-fashioned. But you write they exhibited something called clinical curiosity. What is that term getting at?
You know, so most of my attendings were these starched white men in starched white coats and bow ties, and their white coats always buttoned all the way up. And our patients at a place like Bellevue, which is a public hospital, were largely immigrants, uninsured people, homeless people. And I always wondered, how will they ever connect? As we brought our attendings to the bedside, I couldn't imagine how this, you know, alcoholic, undocumented Honduran immigrant will relate to this, you know, gray-haired white guy with a bow tie. Yet, these doctors were very patient. They very much wanted to know what was going on with the patient. And they asked many questions. They did thorough physical exams. They were interested. And that interest in itself was a form of empathy and respect. And the patients got it. And they worshiped these doctors. They really felt these doctors cared about them, and they did. And so they didn't need to share the same characteristics. And these doctors didn't need to have been in the Peace Corps or backpacked in Nepal, but they were just interested in their patients, and patients pick up on that.
I wonder if, you know, I think about, I have two fairly young kids, and they see doctors at kind of the rate that most children see doctors. And I think of all the pediatricians they've been in touch with, and it feels like there's some built-in empathy that comes with being a pediatrician. And maybe it's not built in, but I wonder if there's something to the idea that pediatricians don't necessarily come into a patient interaction feeling like their patients have made poor personal choices.
Well, one of the lovely things about pediatrics, which I really appreciated more as a parent than I did as a medical student rotating in pediatrics, is that, you know, kids, by and large, you know, they call it like it is. There's not a lot of premeditation. There's not much lying. It is what it is. And there's something really beautiful about that. Though when they actually study empathy, and there are scales that measure empathy, students who score higher in these empathy scales tend to go into primary care fields like pediatrics, obstetrics, internal medicine, family medicine, because they enjoy being with people. That connection gives them a lot of pleasure.
Where does humor come in? There's a lot of humor that you write about that doctors would probably find familiar and that patients might be a little aghast to learn about. But is it possible to have both empathy but also possess this kind of gallows humor that goes along with it?
You know, humor is one of those strange beasts. I mean, it's everywhere in medicine. And we all think, oh, this is so inappropriate. Yet I once worked with an attending in the intensive care unit who was from Tennessee, was also Jewish, if you can imagine kind of that Brooklyn humor, dryness, and Tennessee drawl combined together, who was always making jokes and often at the expense of the patients. And I once confronted him and he said, you know, everyone is dying here. What can you do but laugh? And I got his point, although at times it was awkward. I think that for many of us, humor is a way to handle situations that are very difficult. And as an attending now, as a senior doctor, I try to be very careful when I hear my team joking when it's not appropriate, but to recognize that the humor is a signal for something big, something uncomfortable. We're in that. We need to see what that is.
You also write, though, that people almost universally in the medical field attempt to compartmentalize what they're going through, and that almost universally it doesn't work so well.
No, it doesn't at all. And I think we use that as a coping mechanism. And to some degree, we need to be able to have some separation. I mean, often when you're with the patient, isn't the time for your own emotions to come spilling in. But if you don't attend to those emotions at some point, they will come out. A wonderful study of oncologists looked at the impact of grief. I mean, oncologists, their patients die at a higher rate than most of us. And they did try to compartmentalize, and universally it was a failure that they would speak about grief would you know, follow them like a shadow. It would creep into their home life, their work life. It affected how they saw the next patients, and that it was a very real part of their lives. And they had to kind of negotiate an armistice with their grief. They had to face it, find a spot for it, but they couldn't ignore it.
Right. I think there's at least one medical center that you write about that that requires young oncologists in particular to go through, I guess these are sort of stress management seminars.
Well, this is in Rochester, where they have the oncology fellows meet weekly to talk about what's happened this week. And part of it is acknowledging all the patients who have died, saying their name, saying a word or two about them. And it's open to anyone, the secretaries, the, you know, the X-ray guys, if they want to come. But it's required for the oncologist to recognize that, you know, this is a very emotional field, and you must have at least a spot to say, I have to acknowledge that, boy, it was a really sad week or a horrible week or a frustrating week, and here are the people who I've lost.
You also point out, though, that it is difficult to definitively quantify how this dynamic affects outcomes, whether it cures more illness or manages more illness, say. At the end of the day, why do you think it matters?
Well, one of the things – and I come from a background of science. My PhD is in biochemistry, so I'm very much attuned to and respect hard numbers. But just because we can't quantify it doesn't mean it shouldn't be important. There are many things in life we can't quantify. At some point we say – this is important. I mean, listen, when you feel sick and you go Google your symptoms, you could probably come up with a correct diagnosis, but it's hard to imagine that you'd feel taken care of. And I think most of us, when we're sick, want to be taken care of by real nurses and actual doctors, not by a computer. And that difference between your medical cure and being taken care of, being healed, it's hard to quantify that, but we all know the difference. And we want to be taken care of when we're sick.
You're right, obviously, from the perspective of a doctor, but, you know, obviously you are a person that's also seen by doctors. And I wonder if most of us who are in the position of just being seen by doctors would be well served to have some thoughts about empathy in mind when they walk in the door of the exam room, not to necessarily empathize with the poor, overworked resident. But is there some role for the patient to play?
I think so. I think that when patients come in, they will get a quick intuitive sense if things are going well or things are not going well, even if they can't put their finger on why. And very often when things are not going well, it has to do with the doctor's emotional state, whether they're overworked, frustrated, whether they've been humiliated by their supervisors. And that directly affects patient care. And I think patients being attuned to that, they may not often have the position or power to change that, but they can be aware that something's going on and not to ignore that gut feeling. And if they feel strong enough, they can say, hey, doc, something's up. Or they can talk to a practice manager, or maybe it's time to switch doctors. But there's no reason to settle for a doctor who's an excellent technician but has poor communication or relating skills. There are enough doctors out there who possess both that we shouldn't have to settle for someone with a bedside manner that rivals a roll of surgical tape.
Well, at the same time, you recently wrote a column in the New York Times in which you consider really just how much it's appropriate to share with your patients, the fine line between empathy and getting in the way by oversharing.
Interestingly, you know, doctors often will share, oh, I had a colonoscopy too, so I know how it feels, or, you know, my father had that cancer. And I think we view it as a way to empathize and connect with our patients. But when these patients were studied, most of them found it actually rather intrusive. And I think finding the line of when you are helpful and when you're actually just expressing your, you know, your own needs and issues. And I think we have to really look at the patient, you know, needs first. And sometimes a little bit of sharing is helpful. But in general, if it hogs the spotlight, it becomes detrimental.
In the midst of all this, what do you get out of playing the cello?
You know, the cello kind of came in sort of randomly when my daughter was taking violin and the teacher suggested it would be helpful to see a parent practice. So I still – and last night I was practicing way before I went to bed. You know, one thing in medicine, once you've been in it for a couple of decades, your learning curve is there, but it you know, flattens a bit. Whereas being in music, I'm still the new student and I'm learning every day climbing the mountain, and that intellectual engagement, but also the aesthetic engagement. You know, there's not a lot in medicine about beauty. And I think beauty has a role in our lives for psychological health, for a place to filter your own emotions, for a way to bring joy. So I find it endlessly stimulating, and it makes me work hard in a way that just kind of keeps me going.
And do you think you're at the point that you're good enough that what comes out of your cello allows you to kind of feel that beauty and that joy?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far. But I think the act of playing and striving, you know, so when you actually – and as soon as you get there, they move the finish line. So now you have a harder piece to play. And so you're always in the act of striving. And that in itself, I think, uses parts of your brain and your soul that make for resilience that I think is helpful in patient care.
Danielle Ofri, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It's a pleasure.
Dr. Danielle Ofri's most recent book is called What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. She's an associate professor of medicine at New York University. She practices at Bellevue Hospital in New York, and she's an occasional contributor to the Well blog for the New York Times. She first spoke with Mitch Teich last fall, and our interview with her first aired last December. Coming up next, dentistry, existentialism, and baseball. They're all woven together seamlessly in a new novel, and we'll find out more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect returns now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. There are a lot of human inventions, like philosophy and religion, that attempt to answer the big questions. Why are we here? Do we have a purpose? Why are we so unhappy so much of the time? Do we have the capacity to change? And what does it mean to be a Boston Red Sox fan when they actually win the World Series? Writer Joshua Ferris manages to take on all of these questions in his new novel, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. His protagonist, Paul, agonizes over these existential issues as he cares for the mouths of his Park Avenue dentistry patients. Ferris was in Milwaukee in June, and he stopped by the studio to talk with me then, but first he shared an excerpt from the book.
My favorite children's book is called Dr. DeSoto by William Stieg. Dr. DeSoto is a mouse dentist who will fix the mouth of any animal who doesn't eat mice. It says so right on the sign hanging outside his shop. Cats and other dangerous animals not accepted for treatment. It's a reasonable policy. It has led me to wonder if I've ever done any work on the mouth of a murderer. One day, a fox shows up outside Dr. DeSoto's office, weeping with pain. Hippocratically bound and inherently kind, Dr. DeSoto is predisposed to help the fox, and his wife, who works as his assistant, encourages him to take pity on the poor beast. So Dr. DeSoto, the brave hero dentist, climbs into the fox's mouth and finds a rotten bicuspid and unusually bad breath. This is how you know that Stieg wasn't a dentist. It's all unusually bad. The fox is grateful to Dr. DeSoto. Yet even knowing that his redeemer is in his mouth at that very moment, working to remedy the pain, the fox itches to eat that tasty little morsel. Dr. DeSoto puts the fox under to extract the tooth, and the fox, laying bare his irrepressible nature, drunkenly mutters how he best likes his mice prepared. That night, Dr. DeSoto has his misgivings about the next day's follow-up. A fox is a fox is a fox. However, he must go through with it. Once he starts a job, he always finishes it. His father, he says, was the same way. My father, too. He'd start to redo the bathroom grout or lay new linoleum in the kitchen with any other man's new project gusto, and when it was exactly one-third complete, he'd leave, drive some distance, sell the car for a low figure, and walk home and hand the money to my mother, weeping. I won't spoil the ending for you, but needless to say, a fox is a fox is a fox. The foremost heroism on display in Dr. DeSoto isn't the mouse's noble determination to help despite the mortal dangers all around, but the touching suggestion, briefly entertained, that the fox might have an innate capacity to change. When I was filling a cavity, or doing a root canal, or extracting a tooth that was beyond repair, I'd think, this could have been prevented. I'd fall back on my old cynical view of human nature. They don't brush, they don't floss, they don't care. A fox is a fox is a fox. But when they did brush and floss, and still lost a tooth, I had to blame something else. And just as predictably, I'd point the finger at cruel nature or an indifferent God. I was always saying bad oral health was entirely in their control, unless I was saying that it was entirely out of their control. Then one day, I had a patient come in, lived around the corner in one of the few remaining low-income housing complexes on the Upper East Side, worked construction, his hands the hands of a blind strangler, no effort beforehand to remove the chewing tobacco encreviced between his teeth. And while I was at work on a little local train wreck in the upper left quadrant, I let my mind wander. This guy probably had poor genes, ignorant parents, a mean childhood. He was never going to take care of his teeth. He never stood a chance of taking care of them. He was going to neglect them until they fell out or he died. Unless by some miracle, he got up from the chair and changed his life. Unless some store of character revealed itself, and with a little guidance from me, he returned in 6 months a new man. But even then, I thought, that change, that character, would have to be in him already. I was never going to manufacture it with a few stern warnings. God knows I'd tried. And pain forgets within the hour what it learns in an instant. The man in the chair was lord over his best impulses no more than he was king of his worst instincts. Change or no change, his fate was out of his hands. The only question that ever remained was, are you a fox or something better?
Joshua Ferris, welcome to Lake Effect. That was lovely.
Thanks, Bonnie. Thanks for having me.
To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, your latest book, which we just heard that wonderful excerpt from, I almost don't know where to start because there are so many things going on here. But I guess that sort of existential angst moves through the entire thing. And Paul, your protagonist, is trying to figure out who he is and if he has the capacity to change.
Yeah, essentially. He's so at odds with the world. He's very unhappy in many respects. He's a well-paid dentist, so he has a job to go to. He has a nice apartment in Brooklyn. He should, by all measures, be a content man, but he's not. And I think that that really goes to the heart of existence. Why is he here? Why do people suffer? How should he spend his time? What kind of meaningful connections will he make with other people while he's here? All of these questions just aggrieve him, and he's trying to find the answer. And it's really not until he discovers he may belong to a little-known religion that he's willing to consider some other alternatives.
It's not only that they aggrieve him, it's that he can't not stop thinking about them. he is possessed by this. I mean, a lot of people think about this stuff, but it doesn't completely shape their days.
Yeah, he's his worst enemy for sure. And I think in part that's because as a dentist, he has people continually coming into the office who are beset by mortal problems. One guy's got cancer. One guy won't floss. The other guy has a cavity that he won't take care of. So these people continually keep him on notice that the march of time is working always. And then there's the fact that he's just sort of ignored, neglected. I think he describes himself at one point as, at best, a colossal inconvenience for people. So he can't really relax his mind from these thoughts.
So why a dentist, looking at that mortal coil unraveling as opposed to, say, a doctor?
Well, because they're so ignored, you know? They have a rich store of wisdom to impart to each patient, but the patient comes in, gets done, and just flees, you know? And I know this as well just by virtue of being a patient, you know? Flossing's no fun. You don't want to have to do it every day. You don't want to have to go in and get your cavity filled or take care of a root canal. So I think this aggrievement that I think defines him has so much to do with the way in which a dentist isn't respected as well as a doctor is. So I think I would have taken that edge off him if I had made him a neurologist or something.
And also, I think dentists are feared in a way that maybe your average GP isn't.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you go in to a doctor, you may be really sick, but they're not going to take a really small metal thing out and start poking you with it, you know, in the most delicate places. I mean, it's just, you know, between the gum and the tooth, you just don't want a metal piece there. And boy, they just know how to do it.
Yeah, there's something about that, I think, that also feeds in. It's like his choice of profession has made sure that he has that distance. Even though he wants the connection with other people so badly, he's almost set himself up to make sure that that distance remains because of the very profession that he has.
Yeah. Well, he's got to create that or he's going to go crazy. He's going to basically kidnap some people and just floss them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, the going postal or going dental.
Going dental.
The other part of this, or one of the other parts of this, is that little known religion that he finds out that he's a part of, that he resists, but he ends up helping him figure out in some ways who he is.
Yeah, he's such an avowed atheist, this guy. And it seems to me that that can become its own dogma. And I think that for the bulk of his life, he describes himself as being so resolute in that opinion. And yet the world is not offering him the kind of solace that he might find being a part of a community that all of a sudden presents itself as a possibility. Does he or does he not belong to this heavily persecuted and little-known religion? And not only does he belong or not belong, does it exist? What makes a religion exist? What differentiates a religion from a cult? These questions start to swirl around him and get him thinking in different directions that I think ultimately does reveal that he's something more than a fox.
It also ties in to his resistance to the modern world of technology as well, because that all feeds into it, because this all begins with a webpage that purports to be by him but isn't.
Right. He sort of comes out of the office, comes out of one of the workstations to discover that there's been a website created in his name on behalf of the dental practice, and nobody has made it in the office. So this really sets him off, and it sets the book in motion in terms of he's got to find out who's done this to him and why. And in the course of that exploration, you also come to learn that he really just wants to belong in ways that he's never really allowed himself or that he doesn't feel legitimate. He wants to belong at first to a family of Catholics, and then he wants to belong to a family of Jews. And he doesn't feel, because he hasn't been born into these traditions, that he belongs there. So when the possibility that he may belong to the Catholics of the Catholics and the Jews of the Jews, he's very intrigued.
Well, he also belongs to another interesting community, and that is of the Red Sox fan.
That's right.
And that permeates the book as well. And having grown up in that Red Sox culture myself, I recognized it instantly. And that shifted for him in 2004 when they won the World Series after 86 years.
Yeah. He has an identity crisis.
He sure does. Yeah. It's a big one.
Well, I wondered if it was a very prevalent condition in Red Sox Nation. You know, I mean, for so many years, the passion and the heartbreak defined the Red Sox in ways that, say, with the Cubs, it didn't, because the Cubs were just sort of expected to lose. The Red Sox were truly expected to win. And in the 86 years that they did not, came very close to doing so. So when they did finally win and won in such a spectacular fashion, I wondered if about a year later, there were some avid fans who wondered, well, who are we now? What makes us unique in the world of baseball? And will we just come to replicate our most reviled enemy?
And we know who that is. Well, maybe listeners here don't know who that is, but of course that's the New York Yankees. I loved the juxtaposition of baseball with this and the Red Sox with this small, you know, as you say, the Jew of the Jew, the Catholic of the Catholic religion, if it exists at all, you know, and somehow needing to find yourself part of something that matters, that other, you know, that you can hang your hat on and say, well, this defines me.
Yeah.
And this is who I am.
You know, I'm just a white guy. I'm some white dude who was sort of had like promiscuous Christianity over the course of his life. I went to different denominations and we would just sort of drift in and out of different churches. And so I never really felt like I had a core identity. And when I was going to school, when I went to college, you know, multiculturalism was very much on everyone's minds. And so the little subcultures that I looked into as an outsider were far richer than my experiences, both at home and sort of within the larger community. So the historic irony for me is that I could be accepted anywhere. You know, nobody would turn me away for this or that because I was the white dude. But, even though I had access to everywhere, I didn't really belong anywhere. And so when I looked into tight-knit religious groups, in particular a friend of mine who I roomed with at Iowa, I went to the University of Iowa, and my roomie there was a Jewish guy from the northern suburbs of Chicago, northwest suburbs of Chicago. And I just got inaugurated into Judaism in a way that was really interesting to me. And I sort of longed for those kind of traditions and the rituals and the community that it provided. And so that's sort of Paul's perspective. The dentist's perspective is to look from the outside in and see all that he's missing. And he really, really wants some of it.
But at the same time, he wants it, but he rejects it. He doesn't want to be defined by someone else.
Right.
He wants to define himself.
Right. And here's the rub, I think, in particular with respect to God, because he can't believe. He's too rational. He's too sort of fixed on the reasoned debate and can't allow himself to think of the possibility. And that really does restrict one's participation in a community that centers itself around God. So I think he's trying to figure out how he might participate, and they kind of fail him. But this particular religion embraces skepticism. And so not only does it dovetail nicely with his need for community, but it also seems to have some theological underpinnings that he might get on board with.
Yes, and his adventures into it are really quite that. They're quite interesting, and he travels to Israel, which is where would you say the headquarters are? Or is there a headquarters?
Yeah, it's kind of like a headquarters. Yeah,
yeah.
A kind of discreet headquarters.
Right.
Out in the desert.
Yeah.
With some goats hanging around.
Exactly. We have to have goats.
It's a low rent headquarters.
Do you think he finds himself? Do you think he finds that belonging?
I think that the more interesting question might be, does he allow himself the possibility of it? When it's foreclosed to you for so long because of a principle or a strong opinion, just getting to the point where you ask yourself if that is all that helpful to you in your life is a big change. And I think he does. I think he asks himself eventually, do I really want to live shrouded in my skepticism, or do I want to allow for the possibility of something that might surprise me? And he gets surprised.
So he does open himself up to the possibility, but he also hangs on to some of himself from before too.
Yeah, well, let's not kid ourselves. Yeah. When people change, they still retain a whole heck of a lot of their old baggage. So, you know, I think it would have been dishonest of me to, you know, present in the closing pages of the book an entirely new person, somebody that wasn't aggrieved by the challenges of being alive. So he retains enough to be irascibly lovable, but you know, he's the same guy, but he's thinking about other ways to live. And I think that does dawn on us from time to time. I'm kind of a skeptic about the amount to which we can change. You know, to the amount to which we can really get outside of ourselves and live an entirely new way. And so I think I try to do as good a job as possible, as good a to allow him to change as much as I think it's humanly possible to change, and see what kind of contentedness might fall over him in the closing bits of the book.
Well, Joshua, it has been such a pleasure, and thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Joshua Ferris's latest novel is called To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, and it was just out in hardcover in June. He spoke with me when he was here for a reading at Boswell Book Company in June, and our interview with him first aired then. 35 years after his death, why are Americans still drawn to the story of John Wayne? Well, we'll take one last break and then get some insight when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. All right, quick, name an actor known for playing cowboys. you could have said Gary Cooper or Gene Autry or even Clint Eastwood. But the name that likely jumped out for most of you was John Wayne. That legendary actor in such films as The Big Trail, Stagecoach, The Quiet Man, and True Grit died 35 years ago last month, but he still exerts a hold over popular culture and the American psyche. It's the full story of the man whose real name was Marion Morrison that writer and film historian Scott Eyman examines in his exhaustive new biography, John Wayne, The Life and Legend. Eyman talked about the book at the end of May at the Milwaukee Public Market, but he first joined Mitch Teich in the studio to explain why, a lifetime after his death, people are still fascinated with John Wayne.
For one thing, he was lucky in his collaborators. He made over a dozen films with John Ford, four or five films with Howard Hawks, four or five films with Henry Hathaway, the cream of the directorial crop of that generation. And John Ford and Howard Hawks are not going away. That's quite clear, because their movies are about more than the narrative. They're about the nature of America and how we got to where we are and the nature of our vision of ourself. And Wayne became the focus of those directors in terms of their interpretation of the American trek west and what it means to be an American. So because of the density of those films and the longevity of the artists that made them, Wayne has himself lasted far longer than most actors can hope to last once they're dead, because standards of beauty and what we look for in actors are as temporal as fashions, really.
So you're saying if John Wayne had toiled for lesser directors whose movies didn't have the same kind of longevity, he'd be somebody we'd see on the late night movie rerun, but we wouldn't be dissecting what he meant to the to American film the way we do today.
Well, it goes into speculative history. What would Jefferson think of iPhones? But yeah, if you take those 30 films, that bulk of 30 films that he made with the A-list directors of his era, who chose him to be their main dramatic focus as opposed to Gary Cooper or Joel McRae or any of the other actors that were his competition, I think we'd be talking about a much different career. And then also there was the sheer emotional size of the man, his capacity to play either tenderness or savagery. He was very strong in the extremes, extreme emotions, and he was also very strong in the middle emotions.
He's also still a symbol as much as anything, isn't he? You still hear Europeans describe American foreign policy in terms of John Wayne movies.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's, I think he'd be surprised about that, because he thought there was a point at which he chose to play certain parts that he wanted to represent, that he meant to represent what he thought of as the national character. He didn't start out that way. He started out as a very insecure, shy child who couldn't talk to the girls that thought he was stunningly handsome because he was just too shy and unsure of himself. But over the years, he accreted a certain self-confidence, and he wanted to feel more of that. So he started to play characters that contained qualities that he wanted for himself. And in so doing, he absorbed those qualities and he played what he wanted to become.
Well, and one of the points you make in this book is that for all the image he crafted of himself as an accidental movie star, he really had his eye on drama from a fairly young age. What did it say about him that he maintained that sort of creation story for as long as he did?
He was a blue-collar kid. He was a jock. The only way he got into college was by an athletic football scholarship at USC. There was no family money to pay him into any kind of college otherwise. And if there's one thing an early 20th century blue-collar jock couldn't admit to, it was, I want to be an actor. That was just not going to go down well in the huddle. So he to his dying day, he always tried to give the impression that it was just somebody tapped him on the shoulder, the football was laying there, he grabbed it and ran with it. It was just something that happened to him and he took advantage of it. And that couldn't be further from the truth. From the time he was a kid in Glendale, he moved there when he was 12 or 13, he was a movie-struck kid. He was part of the drama club in high school. He acted in school plays. As soon as he got to Fox as a summer job to help support himself while he was at college at USC, he was started pestering people, put me in movie, put me in movies, use me in this, use me in that. And they told him quite sensibly, you're too big. You're 6'4". All these other actors are 5'8" and 5'9". Six-footers were very unusual in the early 20th century. We can't use you because it'll look like a Mutt and Jeff comedy. So getting parts was very, very difficult for him. But he was always – it was something he always wanted to do. And he was very driven and he was very focused because he came from a – his father was something of an ineffectual failure. And he was quite the reverse. He meant to be successful.
There's a really remarkable picture in the photographic collection that's in the middle that I think John Wayne is an extra and he just towers over everyone.
He's a full head tall. He was 6 foot three and three quarters and with normal shoes – he's over 6 foot four. So, yeah, and in that era, people were just much, much more smaller and more petite. So he was very difficult to cast him.
You mentioned John Ford. Talk about his relationship with John Ford. It started really early in his career. It kind of went by the wayside for a while, but by the end of his career, it was really as important as any of the relationships he had in the film industry.
More important. Ford was not just his father figure. He was Ford was the Michelangelo of John Wayne's career. He saw this block of marble and he started carving away at it. And that the character that you see starting to take shape in Stagecoach, the first film he starred in for Ford, by the time they made The Searchers and Liberty Valance, 25 years later, is a far more complex, far more audacious creation. Wayne regarded Ford as his, not just his father figure, but as the person to whom he owed his career, his life, his home, the bread that he ate. And he would take anything from Ford, and did. I mean, if Ford loved you, he abused you. If Ford really loved you, he abused you terribly. If Ford didn't like you or disliked you, then you didn't exist. He saw right through you and you weren't in the room. That was pretty much the way John Ford operated.
Well, and there was this whole period where John Wayne had all sorts of roles in all sorts of movies, mainly through the Depression. His success at the end of that period, he came out a different person than the first time John Ford worked with him.
Well, Wayne made a big, audacious 70-millimeter spectacular Western in 1930 called The Big Trail. It was meant to turn him into the next Tom Mix as far as Fox Studios was concerned. Instead, it dropped dead and lost a great deal of money. And Wayne, who had been a rising hot young star at the age of 22, was a washed-up has-been at the age of 23. And for the next 10 years, almost 10 years, he basically had to take whatever he could get. He became a jobbing actor. He made dozens of disposable B-movies, Westerns usually. He got large parts in tiny films and tiny parts in large films. But at the same time, while all this was going on, he was learning his craft. If you look at a John Wayne B-Western from 1932 or 33 and look at a John Wayne B-Western in 1937 and 1938, there's a great difference in his authority, in his concision, in his ability to project character, and in his comfort level with dialogue. Because of the immersion of films, constantly working, he became a much better actor than he had been in 1930. I think I say in the book that he was a born movie star, which he was. He had looks, he had charisma, but he was not a born actor. He had to learn how to be an actor. And those 10 years in the wilderness, which he resented mightily all of his life, actually, those 10 years in the wilderness taught him his craft. Those were the foundation stones of the John Wayne we think of as this monolithic construct. He had to teach himself how to act and how to learn his craft.
Well, and so let's flash forward some decades, because as his star rose, his ability to pick and choose what he involved himself in obviously increased. What was it about The Alamo that made him so adamantly want to make that picture, despite all the forces fighting it and him?
He saw it as the perfect metaphor for what America needed to be. There were 200-odd men inside the Alamo fighting off 10,000 Mexicans, and they fought them off for a long time. And he thought, we ought to be able to do that. We're Americans, damn it. and it became a personal quest for him, partially, I suspect, because so many people objected to it and told him he couldn't do it because he was extremely stubborn and single-minded. And once he set his mind to something, it didn't matter how many people said, you're not going to do it. He just became even more determined to do it. Nobody would finance it with him as director. See, they would happily have financed a film with him acting in The Alamo with anyone, John Ford directing, Howard Hawks directing, William Wellman, Henry Hathaway, all of whom he could have asked to direct the picture, any of whom would have directed the picture. But he was determined to direct it himself because, as he told me when I interviewed him in 1972, I wanted to tell the story my way, not Jack Ford's way, not Howard Hawks' way, my way. And it cost him a great deal of money, a great deal of prestige.
Sounds like it almost became a metaphor for itself.
It did. It was one of like Apocalypse Now. It was one of those movies about a war, about a catastrophe that was in itself a kind of war and catastrophe.
Duke's last film was The Shootist, which proved to be, again, kind of a metaphor for where John Wayne was at that point in his life.
He was his health was spiraling down as they were making the picture. They had to shut the picture down for 2 weeks. It was extraordinarily difficult to get the picture finished. He caught a cold in Carson City where they were shooting the locations, and he had had cancer surgery. He lost a lung to cancer in 1963. And at every point after that, whenever he caught a cold, it was odds on it would turn into bronchitis, possibly turning into pneumonia, and then it was going to be trouble. And that's what happened in Carson City. He caught a cold. It became much worse, and he couldn't breathe. So they had to shut the picture down for 2 entire weeks. And they were never sure for a lot of those 2 weeks if he was going to be able to come back and make the picture.
Right. They were shooting scenes without him with doubles.
They were shooting the climactic gunfight with doubles because that was the point. They were able to shoot him entering the bar where the final shootout takes place. But then he got sick. So they shot the entire sequence with doubles. And it was extraordinarily difficult. And you were obviously losing a lot because you couldn't see his face with all the action going on. But they were worried they were going to have an unreleasable picture on their hands. They had to cobble together something. He pulled it together. He got back to the set. They finished the picture. But he hated the director. The director hated him. It was a pitch battle from day one. It was just one of those pictures that's so incredibly hard to make. But when you see it, it's like water over rocks. It flows. It's a beautiful picture. It's a beautiful, restrained, sober performance. And there's really no sense of the stress and strain that went into it. But he never made another movie because his health continued to deteriorate for the last 2.5 years of his life.
Well, that was interesting. The last picture, if you will, he made was a set of commercials for a bank, which you write were actually pretty well received for bank commercials.
Right. He had cash flow issues. So he started doing commercials for a bank in California. And they were extraordinarily successful, drew a lot of business to the bank, a lot of deposits to the bank. And they were shot in places like Oregon. And they're actually very well done. They're shot by Haskell Wexler, the great cinematographer of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Bound for Glory, and directed by Haskell Wexler, who was about as far left as Wayne was far right. So they had some interesting sessions there, but I talked to Haskell, and he ended up thinking a great deal of Wayne.
John Wayne's last public appearance was on the Academy Awards broadcast in 1979 when he announced the award for Best Picture. It surprised a lot of people that he was willing to make that appearance when he was really almost dying.
He was dying. He was, in fact, dying. He had a radiation treatment for the cancer that morning. Got into a van and was driven to the site of the broadcast. He had to lay down. His strength was waning. He'd lost already at that point 40 pounds. He looked very thin. He had to have a new tuxedo fitted because his old tuxedo hung on him. And he was clearly had cancer and wasn't going to make it. But he had promised to award the Best Picture award, and he kept his promises despite everything. And he had to rehearse walking down the steps of the set, because his strength was really not there. So he had to build himself up emotionally and physically and psychologically for those 2 minutes or 3 minutes that he was on camera. And when he showed up backstage, everybody was shocked because they hadn't seen him and they didn't know to what extent his health had been affected by his illness. But it became obvious. And everybody wanted to see him and tell him how happy they were to see him. Jane Fonda was there, who was a childhood friend because he had been very close with Henry Fonda when they were both in the John Ford stock company. Laurence Olivier was there. I think he got an honorary Oscar that year, and he wanted to see Wayne. I mean, everybody congregated. And it was the last time he appeared in public.
You say, as you mentioned, you had the chance to interview John Wayne back in 1972. How introspective was he at the time you spoke with him?
He was who he seemed to be on the screen, but he was somebody else as well. He was huge physically and emotionally. His emotional size really did fill the room. And he was very intimidating, except he put you at ease very quickly. Within 5 minutes, you were just having a conversation. There was no, oh, my God, I'm talking to John Wayne. He's going to kill me. He was very calm. He was reflective. He was contemplative. If you asked him a serious question, he'd think about it and give you a serious answer. There was nothing rote about, and this is a guy who'd been interviewed, 50,000 times. And I had no business interviewing him. I was a 21-year-old kid with almost no credentials. But he was.
How did you happen to get that interview?
I wrote him a letter. And his secretary wrote me back and said, well, if you're out here, I was living in Ohio at the time. She said, if you're out here, I'll do my best to hook you up. And I showed up in California, Hollywood, about 8 weeks later, 8, 9 weeks later, called her. She said, well, he's shooting a TV show at CBS. He's got plenty of time. Show up at 1 o'clock. So I did, and he was in his dressing room, and he had nothing to do. It was a fifth CBS was shooting a salute to CBS, basically. 50 glorious years of CBS. So Lucille Ball was there, and Jack Benny was there, and Bob Hope was there, and a bunch of people who had nothing to do with CBS, but they were just the great stars of that generation. And John Wayne was among them, and he was sitting in his dressing room, and every 20 minutes or so, somebody would stick their head in and say, we're not quite ready for you, Mr. Wayne. And he said, that's okay. I'm with my friend here. And we talked for 90 minutes, and I asked him questions about John Ford and Hawks, and I didn't ask him about cancer. I didn't ask him about politics. We talked strictly about movies, and what I didn't understand at the time, but I came to understand later after talking to more people that were similar to him, is that he was a journeyman picture man, by which I mean most people in the movies love the money of the movies. They love the fame of the movies, the publicity. You get good tables at restaurants, all that. They don't really like the work because it's not a lot of fun. You act for 30 seconds. You wait for half an hour. You act for a minute. You wait for 2 hours while they set the camera and the lights. Wayne loved the process. He loved being on a set. He loved joshing with the stuntman. He loved running lines with actors. He liked working with young actors who were inexperienced and helping them get their craft the way older actors had once helped him get his craft. He liked getting there at 7 in the morning. He liked everything about the process. And very few people are like that. He loved the process. In fact, he was a workaholic. I think a movie set was his home, was the place where he felt most comfortable and most himself. And for that reason, his marriages were often compromised because after 3 or 4 weeks, he'd start to get restless about being at home because he wasn't working. And he was also a depression kid. His family was poor, so it was important for him psychologically to be working, to have the money coming in, because he was always worried about money, and he always wanted to be wealthy, and he wasn't really.
Well, Scott Eyman, it's a fascinating read. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Happy to do it, Mitch. Thank you.
Scott Eyman's new book is called John Wayne, The Life and Legend. He first spoke with Mitch Tyke in May, and our interview with him first aired then. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.